Tonight we are in 2 Kings chapter 12. If you want to open there, although I will tell you that tonight we're going to spend almost our entire time of study in 2 Chronicles. There have been a couple of occasions so far that we have turned over to Chronicles and used the parallel accounts there to kind of elaborate on certain ideas. We said that we're not trying to do, strictly speaking, a harmony of Kings and Chronicles. We're just trying to focus on the account of the monarchy in Samuel and Kings. But there are places where we said we're going to need to go over to Chronicles in order to elaborate more fully. And tonight is one of those nights. There will be just a few more before we finish with this particular study. Last week, we saw the providential preservation of the child king Joash. You remember that Athaliah takes the throne by force after the death of her son, and she proceeds to exterminate all of the royal heirs, believing that she has killed, presumably those that might even include her own grandchildren. But she misses one. Jehoiada, the daughter of the king who has died, the wife of Jehosheba, the daughter of the king who has died, the wife of the high priest who is Jehoiada, takes the baby Joash and hides him for a period of 6 or 7 years. During that time, he is being raised in the house, in the royal house, of the very family and ruler that would desire his destruction. You see very clearly overtones of Moses and of Jesus, who also were sentenced to death as infants and yet were providentially spared. He is raised in the house for that time, and then Jehoiada gathers the temple guard and places him on the throne. Now, you might imagine that this story would have a very happy ending based upon this miraculous survival and preservation that Joash is the beneficiary of. But if you imagine that it's going to have a happy ending, I'm here to tell you tonight, unfortunately, that you're wrong. Joash's story does not end well. For whatever reason, the writer of Kings does not focus upon the apostasy of Joash. I think Dale Ralph Davis is correct in describing the account of Kings as summarizing Joash's life as a disappointment, whereas the writer of Chronicles summarizes it as a story of apostasy. But Joash's story is a sobering reminder that God sovereignly appoints, provides, and preserves those who serve His purposes. But it is also a caution that without the sustaining grace of God, none of us will persevere, but every one of us would be lost. And that's a hard lesson to hear. But that's what we learn from Joash. Joash, if you look at his life during the first part of his life, during the time of his administration that Jehoiada survives, you would imagine that he is a truly converted man, that he is a faithful man, that he loves Yahweh, that he is a spiritual leader, even independent of Jehoiada, or so you would think. But as soon as Jehoiada is gone, we see that he does not have true faith in the Lord. And I don't think there's any question here about Joash's apostasy. It may be that at some point tonight you want to question that and say maybe he's just backsliding in certain ways. I'm going to suggest that the account in Chronicles is pretty definitive. I want to develop this under three headings, but I do want to take those headings really out of the text in Chronicles. Before we get there, I want us to read the entirety of 2 Kings 12. So neither of these chapters are lengthy. I'm going to read all of 2 Kings 12, and then we'll go over to Chronicles and just spend our time developing the story in that place. Let me pick up in verse 21 of 2 Kings 11, just to remind you of kind of where we're at, and then we'll move through chapter 12. Jehoash, another spelling of Joash. Jehoash was 7 years old when he began to reign. In the 7th year of Jehu, Jehoash began to reign, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. And Jehoash did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh all his days, because Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away. The people continued to sacrifice and make offerings on the high places. Jehoash said to the priests, "All the money of the holy things that is brought into the house of Yahweh, the money for which each man is assessed, the money from the assessment of persons, and the money that a man's heart prompts him to bring into the house of Yahweh, let the priests take each from his donor, and let them repair the house wherever any need of repairs is discovered." But by the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priests had made no repairs on the house. Therefore, King Jehoash summoned Jehoiada the priest and the other priests and said to them, "Why are you not repairing the house? Now therefore, take no more money from your donors, but hand it over for the repair of the house." So the priests agreed that they should take no more money from the people and that they should not repair the house. Then Jehoiada the priest took a chest and bored a hole in the lid of it and set it beside the altar on the right side as one entered the house of Yahweh. And the priests who guarded the threshold put in it all the money that was brought into the house of Yahweh. And whenever they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's secretary and the high priest came up, and they bagged and counted the money that was found in the house of Yahweh. Then they would give the money that was weighed out into the hands of the workmen who had oversight of the house of the Lord. And they paid it out to the carpenters and the builders who worked on the house of Yahweh, and to the masons and the stone cutters, as well as to buy timber and quarried stone for making repairs on the house of Yahweh, and for any outlay for the repairs of the house. But there were not made for the house of Yahweh basins of silver, snuffers, bowls, trumpets, or any vessels of gold or of silver from the money that was brought into the house of Yahweh, for that was given to the workmen who were repairing the house of Yahweh with it. And they did not ask for an accounting from the men into whose hand they delivered the money to pay out to the workmen, for they dealt honestly. The money from the guilt offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought into the house of Yahweh. It belonged to the priest. At that time, Hazael, king of Syria, went up and fought against Gath and took it. But when Hazael set his face to go up against Jerusalem, Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the sacred gifts that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah and his fathers, the kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred gifts, and all the gold that was found in the treasuries of the house of Yahweh and of the king's house, and sent these to Hazael, king of Syria. Then Hazael went away from Jerusalem. Now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? His servants arose and made a conspiracy and struck down Joash in the house of Milo on the way that goes down to Silah. It was Jozachar, the son of Shimeath, and Jehozabad, the son of Shomer, his servants, who struck him down so that he died. And they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Amaziah, his son, reigned in his place. Now, if that was the only record that you had of Joash's life, I dare say you would come away with a very different idea about Joash's character. If you are a careful reader, you're going to pick up on the fact that the writer is suggesting that Joash is a disappointment, that not all is well in Jerusalem. So at the beginning, the assessment seems very positive. He served the Lord all his days as long as Jehoiada is with him. Your ESV here may be a little bit misleading, not because it's a wrong translation, but maybe it's not the best way to translate this. He served the Lord all his days because Jehoiada instructed him. But as we see in Chronicles, it was not all his days. It was all the days that Jehoiada instructed him. And after that, he didn't serve the Lord anymore. As you move into the temple renovation project, the repairs that are to be made, you see what may seem like an independent faith that Joash has. Here he wants to renovate the temple. We don't know exactly what year that was ordered. But by the 23rd year, he's 30 years old, and he says these repairs haven't been made, and you priests are obviously not going to get the job done. I'm going to contract this out. And he arranges that, he calls them to account for that, he performs that work, all of that seems very good. And then immediately, you have the record of the Syrians showing up and him offering a bribe. Now you may say, well, Pastor, that's not that bad. I mean, that's just the way that the world works, and it seems to have worked in this case. It was politically expedient. But you never have in Scripture a favorable perspective upon this kind of bribing of foreign rulers. He sacks the temple for them. I mean, that's essentially what he does. He takes the gold out of the house of Yahweh and out of the king's house, and he says, here, you don't have to come and take it. We'll just give it to you, right? And when you see that, you say, Maybe Joash is not as strong and as powerful a leader as we once thought. And then immediately after that, what do you find out about Joash's death? He doesn't die of old age. He is assassinated Now, assassination, we haven't seen in the southern kingdom, except for Athaliah exterminating the royal house, but we haven't seen a sitting monarch assassinated at this point in this way. Jehu, he kills Ahaziah, but that has a very different feel, a very different context. It's almost an act of military engagement because it's by a foreign dignitary, right? But this is an assassination at home. This is another Judean killing the king of Judah, and yet it was not for the purpose that we see in the northern kingdom. In the northern kingdom, assassinations happened a number of times, and each time it is in service of a coup that seeks to place the assassins upon the throne. That's not the case here. Who takes the throne from Joash? His son, Amaziah. The assassins apparently are not hostile to the family of Joash. They're not seeking to unseat or usurp the family of David. They are actually simply against Joash himself. And when you turn the page to Chronicles, you're going to understand why. So let's go over to 2 Chronicles chapter 24. This chapter we'll work through a little bit more slowly, obviously. I'm not going to read the entirety of it at the very beginning, but I want to read it piece by piece. 2 Chronicles chapter 24, much of the material is parallel, not all of it is. There are some important differences in a couple of places. Let me read the first 14 verses with you. Joash was 7 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba, and Joash did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh all the days of Jehoiada the priest. Jehoiada got for him 2 wives, and he had sons and daughters. After this, Joash decided to restore the house of Yahweh, and he gathered the priests and the Levites and said to them, "Go out to the cities of Judah and gather from all Israel money to repair the house of your God from year to year, and see that you act quickly." But the Levites did not act quickly. So the king summoned Jehoiada the chief and said to him, "Why have you not required the Levites to bring in from Judah and Jerusalem the tax levied by Moses, the servant of Yahweh, and the congregation of Israel for the tent of testimony?" For the sons of Athaliah, that wicked woman, had broken into the house of God, and had also used all the dedicated things of the house of Yahweh for the Baals. So the king commanded, and they made a chest and set it outside the gate of the house of Yahweh. And proclamation was made throughout Judah and Jerusalem to bring in for Yahweh the tax that Moses, the servant of God, laid on Israel in the wilderness. And all the princes and all the people rejoiced and brought their tax and dropped it into the chest until they had finished. And whenever the chest was brought to the king's officers by the Levites, when they saw that there was much money in it, the king's secretary and the officer of the chief priest would come and empty the chest and take it and return it to its place. Thus they did day after day and collected money in abundance. And the king and Jehoiada gave it to those who had charge of the work of the house of Yahweh, and they hired masons and carpenters to restore the house of Yahweh, and also workers in iron and bronze to repair the house of Yahweh. So those who were engaged in the work labored, and the repairing went forward in their hands, and they restored the house of God to its proper condition and strengthened it. And when they had finished, they brought the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada, and with it were made utensils for the house of Yahweh, both for the service and for the burnt offerings, and dishes for incense and vessels of gold and silver. And they offered burnt offerings in the house of Yahweh regularly all the days of Jehoiada. Now, something that you need to recognize here is that the temple renovation project, as it's described in Kings, sounds almost like it could have lasted a very long time. We don't know when he originally gave the order, and we don't know exactly how long the priests failed to follow through. But the account here in Chronicles gives us a little bit more information. Not definitive dating, but if you'll notice in verse 3, Jehoiada got for Joash 2 wives. He had sons and daughters. After this, Joash decided to restore the temple. And so if we're to understand that chronologically, then we would assume that Joash gives this order when he's already a grown man and when he is already having offspring and a family. Now, that still could have happened fairly young, right? He comes to the throne at 7. We're not assuming that he waits until he's 25 to get married and start having babies, right? But nonetheless, it is an indication that it could have been at any point after he reaches maturity. This is an idea that he seems to propose. It doesn't appear to come from Jehoiada. step, but seems to be something that Joash himself is eager to do. When he gives the initial instructions about renovation and restoration in the temple, he instructs the Levites to go out and get that money and to do this quickly. And that's what they failed to do. Again, the text in Kings is a little more ambiguous. You don't know, have they collected all of the money and then they just don't make the repairs that are needed? Chronicles at least leaves the impression that it broke down from the very beginning, that they don't follow through in collecting the funds, the offerings that are prescribed by the law, and therefore it doesn't get off the ground. Now, however long that persists, Joash eventually realizes the negligence. It does not appear in any way that there is dishonesty on the part of the priests. You notice that the priests remain involved in the project. Jehoiada remains involved in the project. It's not as though he disciplines the priests and says, you can't be trusted, you're embezzling these funds or something like that. No, it's just that they haven't followed through. They're just very busy and they've got their minds on other things and it's not sufficiently important to them. But Joash says, no, we're going to make sure that this gets done. And so he takes the chest, he puts it in the entrance to the temple courts, and that way people bring their offerings directly and they put their offerings in. You're not having to send Levites out throughout the countryside in order to collect this. He's saying, you come and you contribute, and then that money will be used for repairs. And they restore the house of God to its original condition, to the way in which it ought to have been from the very beginning. Now, this first section in 2 Chronicles I've titled Joash's Faithfulness. Joash's faithfulness. And I want to suggest two applications from this for you to think about tonight. The first is the importance of godly mentors. As long as Jehoiada is around, Joash does really well. He appears to be a man who is easily manipulated, unfortunately. We'll see that in just a moment when we come to the second section. But at least in that sense, he is willing to follow those who have leadership ability who are around him. And in this case, he's willing to follow Jehoiada for a long time. How important are godly role models and teachers and those to walk alongside and help us in serving God? I think we may grossly underestimate the importance of this aspect of church life, right? Of the community of faith. If we go to the New Testament, we see often in the apostolic writings references to godly mentoring. You can see this in 1 Corinthians 11 when Paul says, imitate me as I also imitate Christ. You can see it when he writes in Philippians chapter 3. And he says, note those who so walk as you have us for a pattern. Right? You can see this in his instruction to Titus with regard to the mess of the churches in Crete. He says, the older men are to teach the younger men, the older women are to teach the younger women. You yourself, Titus, are to be an example to the believers. And he says something similar to Timothy as well. How different might this story have been if Joash had living mentors and companions to encourage him in righteousness rather than in rebellion? Everyone needs at least three people in their lives, it's been said. Someone ahead of you who's further down the road, who can help you find the path. Someone alongside of you who can walk with you as a companion on the journey. Someone behind you that you yourself can encourage and be a role model to. I think interestingly, even though this is written far before the development of those kind of mentoring models, you can see that very structure in Pilgrim's Progress. You can see Christian has men who are helping him along the road, who are further down that road, who would have walked this path before. You have those who come alongside of him at different points to encourage him and help him, especially during the persecution at Vanity Fair. And then you have men who are behind him and others who are encouraged by him and even by the stories of him, even after he reaches the celestial city. Everyone needs people like that in their lives. And so if you do not have godly mentoring and accountability, you need to seek that out. Very deliberately, you need to seek that out. You need to have people who are helping you find the path, who are helping you walk the path, and whom you are able to help walk that path. Secondly, is related, but a second point, the importance of accountability in our deeds, in our actions. The priests here, as we said, do not appear to have been dishonest. They were simply busy and perhaps, at least with regard to this project, lazy. And they needed accountability for following through and getting things done. And if a project is worth doing, it said it's worth doing well. Well, in this case, isn't the work of God worth doing well and worth doing in a timely manner? We looked on Sunday at the book of Haggai. And we saw was that Sunday or was that last Sunday? I don't remember. Recently, we looked at Haggai. I'm already thinking about the next couple of weeks. But anyway, Haggai's encouragement to the returns to the captives who have returned from Babylonian exile, it's time to build. You know, you've been here quite a while. You've had time to build your own houses. You've had time to put in paneling. It's time for you to build the house of the Lord. And we need that kind of accountability. We need people who are going to keep us honest. Even priests sometimes need accountability and discipline to help them follow through and finish what they started. And again, you and I need to welcome that in our lives. We need defensiveness is one of our worst traits as human beings. Our pride is involved. Selfishness is involved. It shuts down our ears. We don't listen. We need to be people that welcome that kind of accountability to say, you know what, thank you for helping me realize that this is something I've neglected. I let the ball drop here. I need this kind of accountability and support. Even Jehoiada needed it, apparently, because the priests are just simply not getting the job done. A lot of positive things to say in those first 14 verses about Joash and his faithfulness. But when we come to verse 15, we see Joash's faithlessness. Look with me at 15 through 22. But Jehoiada grew old and full of days and died. He was 130 years old at his death. And they buried him in the city of David among the kings because he had done good in Israel and toward God and his house. Now after the death of Jehoiada, the princes of Judah came and paid homage to the king. And the king listened to them. And they abandoned the house of Yahweh, the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and the idols. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this guilt of theirs. Yet he sent prophets among them to bring them back to Yahweh. These testified against them, but they would not pay attention. Then the Spirit of God clothed Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada the priest, and he stood above the people and said to them, "Thus says God, why do you break the commandments of Yahweh so that you cannot prosper? Because you have forsaken Yahweh, he has forsaken you." But they conspired against him. And by command of the king, they stoned him with stones in the court of the house of Yahweh. Thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness that Jehoiada, Zechariah's father, had shown him, but killed his son. And when he was dying, he said, "May Yahweh see and avenge." This is where the history of Kings and Chronicles diverges, and you'll forgive me for jumping over to Chronicles tonight. I just don't think I can do justice to Joash's story without telling you the rest of the story. These two histories are not in contradiction. They have unique emphases because of their different perspectives, because of their different points of focus. Kings describes Joash's bribe of Hazael, the king of Syria, in order to save Jerusalem. But here, Chronicles focuses on his actual apostasy altogether. What we saw in Kings was an act of distrust rather than faith. But that only hints at the greater moral and spiritual failings that are described in Chronicles. So in Chronicles, when Jehoiada dies, and by the way, Jehoiada is an old guy when he dies. You may say, "Oh, there's a lot of people in the Bible that live older than 130. Not at this point in Bible history. I mean, this is old. Right? He is an old man. Praise God that he preserves him that long. But after Jehoiada's death, who shows up? It's not as the, this is again why I would say that apparently Joash is the kind of person who is easily manipulated, easily led. Maybe he doesn't have leadership gifts. I don't know. But he easily listens to other people. It seems he's willing to listen to Jehoiada while he's there. But then the princes of Judah show up. Now, what does that tell you immediately? That the princes of Judah show up immediately after Jehoiada's funeral. And what do they want? And how do they get it? They pay homage to the king, and the very next thing that you see is the people abandon the temple. They abandon the worship of Yahweh. They import idolatry once again. And Yahweh curses them as a result of it. What it tells you is that the leadership of the nation was not on board with Jehoiada's reforms. They were not on board with the things that Joash, under the mentorship of Jehoiada, had been doing. Their heart is not loyal to Yahweh. They were willing to play the game. They were willing to go along for a time while it was politically expedient to be part of the party of Yahweh. But once the pressure was off, once Jehoiada's oversight was at an end, they openly embraced the idolatry that they had always loved. But what does it tell you about Joash that he goes along with this? It tells you that he was never truly converted, that he was never personally convicted. And you may say, no, Pastor, that's too harsh of a judgment. You're reading his heart. I'm not reading his heart. I'm reading the story. He does not merely fall prey to the manipulation of the princes of Judah. He murders his stepbrother. He murders Jehoiada's son. It is by the command of the king that Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, is stoned. And it is because he had the audacity to stand up and say, what you're doing is not right. And he paid for it with his life. I don't know what kind of relationship Joash and Zechariah may have had. Zechariah may have been much older than Joash. I mean, after all, Jehoiada is pretty old at the time that he adopts Joash as a son. They may not have been intimate. But what the text says is Joash did not remember the kindness of Jehoiada. You don't kill the son of your foster father, right? You just don't. Whether you have any relationship with that man or not, you just don't do that. Zechariah is precious to Joash, if for no other reason than that Jehoiada is precious to him. There are friends that I have whose children are important to me simply because I love their father. And when their father is dead and gone, those children will be able to call me at any point, and I will have a commitment to them because I have a covenant commitment to their father. And what we see here is that Joash does not have such loyalty. In his faithlessness, we see the betrayal of religion, the betrayal of truth, and the betrayal of loyalty. The earlier Reformation was only external, not internal. And so Yahweh sends prophets to the people, but they will not listen. And when Zechariah shows up, he prophesies against Joash, and it costs him his life. How great is that man's depravity? But listen again to what Zechariah said. He says, why do you break the commandments of Yahweh so that you cannot prosper? You want to be destroyed? You want to see your life fall into ruin? You want to see your home fall into chaos? Then disregard God. Disregard God. That doesn't mean that if you worship God, everything's going to be swell. Everything's going to be easy. Everybody's going to just love each other and always get along. And the sun's always going to shine. And you know, the kids will have never have eaten all of the bagels for breakfast, you know, things like that. No, I mean, they're going to be difficult days. But you want to destroy your family and your life? Disregard God. That's what Zechariah says. Why have you abandoned the Lord so that you cannot prosper? It's not possible for you to prosper while you're doing this. And this is what you know, we should say about our families, about congregations, about nations, right? That doesn't mean that there can't be a season of economic prosperity. You may disregard the Lord and suddenly find that you're able to make a lot more money if you're not serving the Lord. You may disregard the Lord and suddenly find that, oh, all of your kids love you more right now because you're not yapping about the Bible all the time and we're just able to have fun. You may be able to disregard the Lord and experience economic success as a nation or military prosperity. But that, how long is that going to last? Not very long. You will not prosper so long as you conduct your life in this way. When you abandon the house of God and you give yourself over to idolatry, be certain that destruction lies before you. He says, because you have forsaken Yahweh, He has forsaken you. And by the way, God is being faithful in doing that. He's being faithful. This is what He promised He would do. He said, you obey me, I will bless you. You disobey me, I will curse you. Yet we have a relationship here. You be faithful to this covenant, or the curses of the covenant will fall upon you. Maybe it's not inappropriate to make this point at this juncture, that when a godly spouse puts away by divorce an ungodly spouse, they are exercising covenantal judgment. They are not saying, and this is the way sometimes it's interpreted, and it's a mistake, and we need to root this out of our thinking. They are not saying, okay, you weren't faithful, so I don't have to be faithful. Right? You broke our covenant relationship, so I can get out of our covenant relationship. And that's not what's happening. God is not saying, you weren't faithful to me, so I won't be faithful to you. He's saying, you have forsaken me, and therefore I, the source of your blessedness, have departed, just as I said. That's the covenant relationship, right? There are conditions. There are blessings for obedience. There are curses for disobedience. And God said, had told the people in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28 that this is what's going to happen. And now Zechariah announces it. Two applications under this heading as well. The first is this. Do not mistake acts of faithfulness for a heart of faithfulness. Those are two very different things. What would most observers assume about Joash during Jehoiada's lifetime? They would assume that he's ruling righteously. I mean, after all, he repairs the temple. He's willing to stand up to Jehoiada and the priests and hold them accountable for their obedience. But what does all of that mean? Righteous rule, temple renovation, boldness in dealing with the priests. You know what all of that means? Nothing. You know why? Because we're not saved by works. For some reason, we forget that. I mean, we say the right thing with our mouths. We say, well, we're saved by grace through faith. But then, for some reason, we think that because a person is faithful, they must be saved. How does that work? You're not saved by being faithful. You're faithful because you're saved. And what happens in Joash's case is we find that he wasn't faithful at all. Acts of faithfulness do not equal a heart of faithfulness. And God is not saving people based upon the accumulation of merit that they have obtained through their obedience. You see, the gospel tells us how to think about this kind of a situation. We are not saved by our works. We are not transformed by our works. We are not made holy by our works. We are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. And the sad reality is that some who are apparently faithful will in the end prove faithless. And you say, what a tragedy it is. Well, it is a tragedy. But it shouldn't be surprising to us. It shouldn't be shocking to us. This is why in this congregation, when we have a funeral or a memorial service for a very faithful Christian, we make the point, every time we make the point, that our hope today is not in the faithfulness and good works of this person. Because we tend to forget that. We look at somebody who's got a lot of faithful deeds and we say, God must love them, right? Well, God is not pleased with what he sees in Joash's heart, and that's very evident. Do not put your confidence in men. Do not put your confidence in your works. Always and only put your confidence in God. It is tragic to sit with a person who is under sentence of death, and when you are seeking to know where does your hope lie, all they can talk about is themselves. And I've done it again this week. It's not good. It's not good. It does not give my heart comfort as a pastor, believe me. Do not trust in your works. Put your confidence in God. Do not confuse acts of faithfulness for a heart of faithfulness. Secondly, hell is a real place for a reason. I don't know how you wrap your mind around the magnitude of Joash's apostasy. He basically commits himself to undoing everything that Jehoiada stood for. Everything. It is not that Jehoiada died and Joash became lax in his temple attendance. Right? I mean, we've seen that. We see some young person that grows up in a godly family, and after mom and dad are gone, they don't renounce the faith, but they're not committed as mom and dad are. Right? Okay, well, we've seen that. That's sad, but that's not really surprising. It's not deeply disturbing. That's not what Joash does. It's like Jehoiada is gone. The princes come and pay tribute to him. And they say, hey, aren't we getting a little tired of this Yahweh thing? I mean, can't we be a little more broad-minded? Can't we be a little more ecumenical here and get some of these other gods involved in the picture? And Joash says, hey, sounds good to me. They abandon the temple. The temple that has just been repaired and then sacked to get the Syrians off their back. That temple is abandoned. And Joash murders a man for speaking truth. That is not an example of backsliding. That is not a lapse in judgment. That is not a moment of weakness. That is apostasy on an incalculable scale. I don't mean by that that Joash could not be saved, but there's only one way he's going to be saved. And that is through repenting and trusting in God. And there's no evidence that he does so. The Lord would see what was done and he would avenge it. And indeed, he does in the very next section. Now, there's one last point that I need to point out here. It's more of a textual note, but it's something that maybe is interesting to you. In Matthew chapter 23, when Jesus is denouncing the scribes and the Pharisees, he says that all of the blood, the righteous blood that was shed from Abel to righteous Zechariah, will come upon this generation. And he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, he's talking about Rome's destruction of the temple in AD 70. And you say, Abel I get. Abel's the first martyr, right? He's murdered for worshiping God righteously by a man who worships God unrighteously. So he's the first martyr. Zechariah? A lot of people don't even know which Zechariah we're talking about. Well, it's this Zechariah. It's Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada. Okay? But even then, people say, but he wasn't the last righteous person killed in the Old Testament. And that's true. He wasn't the last righteous person killed in the Old Testament, period. But he is actually the last righteous martyr in the Old Testament canon. And in order to understand this, you have to understand that the books in the Hebrew Bible appear in a different order than yours do. We've made this point in Sunday school. Our English Bibles are arranged in terms of genre. They're grouped by literary type. And so Chronicles comes right after Kings. That's good, that's helpful, that's perfectly appropriate. But in the Hebrew Bible, Chronicles is at the end of the Old Testament, as we think of it. It's at the end of the Hebrew Bible. And so what Jesus is doing there is he's essentially saying all of the martyrs throughout redemptive history down to our present time, all of that blood God is going to bring upon you. So we would say from Genesis to Revelation, or we might say referencing the Old Testament, from Genesis to Malachi. But Jesus, reading the Hebrew Bible, would say from Genesis to Chronicles. And that's essentially what he does there in Matthew 23. All right, verse 23. Here's the third heading. And I've named this Joash's forfeiture. He forfeits the blessings of the covenant, and he forfeits his own life. At the end of the year, the army of the Syrians came up against Joash. They came to Judah and Jerusalem and destroyed all the princes of the people from among the people and sent all their spoil to the king of Damascus. Though the army of the Syrians had come with few men, Yahweh delivered into their hand a very great army because Judah had forsaken Yahweh, the God of their fathers. Thus they executed judgment on Joash. When they had departed from him, leaving him severely wounded, his servants conspired against him because of the blood of the son of Jehoiada the priest and killed him on his bed. So he died. And they buried him in the city of David, but they did not bury him in the tombs of the kings. Those who conspired against him were Zabad, the son of Shimeath, the Ammonite, and Jehozabad, the son of Shimrith, the Moabite. Accounts of his sons and of the many oracles against him and of the rebuilding of the house of God are written in the story of the book of the Kings. And Amaziah, his son, reigned in his place. I do not think that this is the same Syrian incursion that is mentioned in Kings. First of all, it appears to occur at a different point in the story. Secondly, there was no mention of Haziel here in Chronicles, whereas he is the primary figure in Kings. And in Kings, Joash gives a bribe to get the Syrians not to do what they actually do here. They come to Jerusalem, they kill the royal princes, the nobles, they don't kill the one heir, right? But they kill the nobles, the leaders of the people, they sack the city, they wound Joash, and then they leave. They're not apparently trying to conquer the city. You would think about this more like a raid, right? It's a raid where they come in to slaughter, and then they withdraw. And why does that happen? Because Yahweh gives them the key to the city. Because Yahweh opens the gates. Because Yahweh raises them up. The Syrians are an instrument of Yahweh's wrath against his covenant-breaking people. It says this is because Judah had forsaken Yahweh, the God of their fathers. And so what happened was an execution of judgment upon Joash. God will not be mocked. And then Joash is in his bed, apparently wounded, personally wounded, and he is assassinated by an Ammonite and a Moabite of all people. That That's kind of fascinating, by the way. If we could comment on that in 2 weeks when we return to their execution. But an Ammonite and a Moabite, but who apparently acts with some plausible justification. Now, I say that, I'm about to say that what they did was wrong, just in full disclosure. But why do they assassinate him? Well, the text says they assassinated him because he killed Zechariah, Jehoiada's son. Now, what's unclear here, at least to me, is was that their conscious motivation, or was that God's sovereign, divine, secret prerogative, right? And I think either reading is possible, because you can notice that the judgment of the Syrians against the house of Judah is attributed to the Lord, but the Syrians are not telling themselves, well, we're going to go and punish Judah for being unfaithful to their God, right? And that's not their motivation. They're just there to create mayhem and obtain spoil. So it's possible that this Ammonite and this Moabite, that they have other personal motivations at play. But here's what's interesting to me. They don't try to put anyone else on the throne. They don't try to destabilize the government. They simply go and they kill the king. And they seem to recognize and accept the fact that his son is going to be the heir in his place, is going to take the throne in his place. That makes me think that they may have been well motivated, at least in terms of avenging Zechariah's murder. Now, it's no coincidence that Judah falls into this trouble. Judah is falling under the hand of the Lord. And both the Syrians and the assassins are instruments in the hand of God. But that does not mean that God is the one who is responsible for doing any evil. Joash's assassination was not a righteous act. And in fact, the next chapter of our story will demonstrate that. But it was a righteous judgment of God, who can use evil deeds to accomplish his holy purpose in the earth. In other words, God can do righteousness through the wickedness of evil men, and there is no greater demonstration of that than the cross of Jesus Christ. The most righteous thing to ever be done by God is the most wicked thing for man to ever do, and that is crucify the Son of God by whom we are saved. Now, although this might seem to once again threaten the Davidic line, just as we saw Athaliah's purging do, Joash already had a son prepared to take the throne in his place. The assassins were not seeking to install themselves. This is not a coup. They appear simply to be rightly offended by the wickedness and betrayal of Joash. They may have been justly angry, but their vengeance was unjust because it was not authorized by God. And that's the first application that we want to think about here. And that is that a righteous cause does not justify unrighteous means. It would be very easy for us in our minds to justify the work of these assassins because Joash deserved to die. He did. I mean, Deuteronomy chapter 13 sentences him to death. So if the priests were actually following the law, if the magistrates, the lesser magistrates, were following the law, they would have brought the king up on charges, there would have been a public trial, and then he would have been killed. So he deserves to die. And then he commits murder on top of that, as if the apostasy was not enough. He commits murder, and he commits murder of the grossest kind, right? And so there's no argument for Joash to live, and yet assassination was wrong. And we cannot justify unrighteousness in the name of righteousness. If Joash was going to be put to death, there was a proper way to do that. There needed to be a legal process. There needed to be charges. There needed to be adjudication. There needed to be a formal pronouncement of judgment and execution thereof. And there wasn't. We got a lot of unrighteousness in the world today, and it would be easy for godly people to convince themselves that this unrighteousness is so egregious that we need to take matters into our own hands and take up arms ourselves. And that would be just as wrong. It would be just as wrong. Not because the cause itself may not be righteous, but because the means thereto are unrighteous. It does matter whether a person is authorized by God to do what he does. It does matter. And in this case, these men were not authorized. Even if they were instruments in God's hands, they were not authorized to do what they did. And the second point is one that I mentioned just a moment ago, and that is God will not be mocked. Joash received great blessings from God, and he was used by him for great good, but that did not buy him a pass. You cannot simply rest upon a history of blessings from God and service to God and disregard God. God will be held in honor among his saints, and the disobedient and reprobates will in the end be exposed and judged by the Lord. And that's going to happen on Judgment Day. We're going to see people that maybe we would have thought were righteous who say, "Lord, Lord, haven't we prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name done many mighty works?" And Jesus will not say, "You did not do enough. You did not do it in the right way." He'll say, "I never knew you at all." God will not be mocked. And we should not despair when we see righteous people seemingly becoming or being exposed as unrighteous people. You just simply say, that's what God said would happen. And as tragic as it is, and as heartbreaking as it can be, blessed be the name of the Lord. His word proves true, right? And we knew that that was going to happen. Now, final note, kind of connecting this more explicitly to Christ. Joash was a Christ child, as we saw last week, but he was not the Christ, and that makes a difference. He was a son of David, but he was not the son of David. He served God's purposes in repairing and restoring the temple, but he could not build the eschatological temple. Only Jesus can be Jesus. Joash could not be. Your pastor and elders cannot be. Your parents cannot be. The pastor that led you to the Lord cannot be. Do not put your trust in men. No matter how greatly they may be used by God, no matter how helpful they may be to his cause. And this is not to say that we should not love and appreciate men. We can and we should. In fact, the Bible itself teaches us to do so. In Philippians chapter 2, Paul says we ought to honor such men as these who give themselves in service of the Lord. Yes, appreciate these men, love these men, but do not put your trust in them. I don't mean to suggest spiritual cynicism, where you're always looking, you know, kind of askance at everyone that seems to be faithful and just wonder, when are you going to commit apostasy? You know, when are you going to betray me? That's not what I'm suggesting. But we should not put our trust and hope in them, but rather fix our eyes on Jesus, because He alone is the Savior of our souls.